Shall we begin? The last couple of lectures have been on issues of physical considerations that really have to do with the global, climatic forces that act on buildings. In particular, the way that natural topography, geography, ecology, rainfall patterns, soil conditions, all of those things affect how we make buildings. And last time, I tried to scare the bejesus out of you, that if you don't pay attention to these things, horrible things happen. I mean, not just like, damn, I hate that building, but like, okay, everything I've collected for my entire life, all of my livelihood, my investment in my home, everything gone, just like that. Because we didn't pay attention to issues of geography, topography, ecology in building. We also, last time, were looking at this kind of larger scale of environmental planning and made the point, there are other kinds of planning, transportation planning, land use planning. Planning is a whole set of issues, very intertwined with architecture, but a little different as well, and that we need to think about policy. It has to do with politics to a fairly large extent. It means that, honestly, if you care about architecture, you got to get your fingernails dirty in terms of politics, and in particular local politics, because municipalities are basically the ones that have the say over this sort of thing. We have a big election coming up November 5th. I got to tell you, I'm all over voting in this election because these issues that we're talking about, they are decided by the people who get elected in these local elections. And we've got 10 new council members and a new mayor that will be elected in Austin on November 5th. We're completely changing our system of government. Rather than at-large representatives, we now have council members elected from districts. And one of those districts is District 9, which basically is a student district. You guys have enormous clout capability, which you've never had in this city before, because of the high concentration of students in District 9, basically West Campus and the areas north and south here. And you could make the difference in this one election, and that would mean that the person who represented that district would either be a voice for issues you might care about, like easy bicycle transportation, mass transit, walkability, and some of these other issues we've been talking about that impact the campus area. Or not. And actually, there's a very clear choice in this election. There are council members that are all over those issues that will be important to students, and there's some people running that are not. So, you make the decision about whether these things work or don't work by your participation in those kinds of political things. So this is something all of us have a say in or just don't become active in. And if we don't become active in it, then it's entirely possible it goes the kind of way we talked about last time, which can be bad. So the Twitter card question last time was asking, give me a bad example of an environment that was screwed up by bad decisions in these terms relating to physical considerations. I said, if you can't think of a bad one, then tell me a good one. And a couple of people came up with good ones. So here are some good ones. I have vacationed many times with my family in New Mexico, which has a mountainous desert geography. The villages are built into the valleys of the mountains where they are protected from strong winds and get just enough water from the mountain runoff. It's a great example of how geography can benefit cities and towns. Yes, locate them appropriately, and it can be quite beneficial. In an arid climate like that, locating a place where it collects water. Someone else says, on the Reed College campus in Portland, Oregon, they have a giant creek that runs through the north center of campus. This creek is inset into the land, which almost creates a little river valley to collect the heavy rains of the Pacific Northwest, while also being a beautiful place on campus. Actually, in the new master plan just completed for the campus, Waller Creek turns into very much that same kind of thing. How can we use it as a way of mitigating flood occurrences, but when we don't have a flood occurrence, have a beautiful oasis right in the middle of campus? And the new medical school is being built around Waller Creek as exactly that kind of dual amenity, serving an ecological purpose and at the same time serving a recreational purpose. Then there were people who found some problems. Someone says, my grandmother's house in China was built with very poor environmental planning. The tall apartment complex was built on soft, wet soil. So with time, the foundation cracked and broke, causing everyone to have to evacuate, and the building was torn down. Whoa, brand new building, ruined because they didn't think about this. Someone else says, Bolivar Peninsula is an extremely low-lying area on the Texas coast. Here, all structures from homes to schools are built on very high stilts. However, there's one shopping center, the only one in Bolivar, built on the ground. Why would anyone do this, especially after Hurricane Ike flooded the entire area? So dumb. Someone else says, suburban areas in the western U.S. that have been built in close proximity or directly in heavily forested areas have been subject to repeated forest fires that have caused massive destruction of property and some loss of human life. Areas of Southern California come to mind as specific examples. Very good point. The fire hazard's equally important here. Someone else says Mexico City had no environmental planning when it was built. Now it's just getting from bad to worse. Apart from being surrounded by mountains, it's located on top of a big body of underground water. When you combine this with the heavy concrete of the city that's been placed on top, you get a sinking city. This is exactly what's happened to Mexico City. Plus, it has an abundant amount of impervious cover, which just creates horrible floods that affect the streets. Someone else says, in Monterrey, Mexico, there is a large dry river running through the city. After decades of dryness, builders decided to place buildings and an entertainment center at the base of the river. 2 years ago, rain filled the river and flushed out millions of dollars of structures and buildings. They learned their lesson. Someone else says, near my house on Grapevine Lake, giant structures were built on the lake's cliff without regard for the erosion that was bound to happen. Over the years, my family has seen the cliff erode to the point where one house is beginning to fall off the edge. The homeowners had to move out as a reinforcing stone wall was built along the cliff to support the house and stop erosion. Someone else says, I'm from Dallas, and in Dallas, I went to school at Emmett Conrad High School. The school has a zero floor, a basement, because it's located on a hill. Whenever the weather gets very bad, rain or snow, school is suspended because the zero floor has a danger of flooding. Although the ground level can survive, the students would be put in danger by having to climb out of this flooded hill. So very good observations of these principles, either working or not working in all these other places. So today we're going to shift gears a little bit. The last two lectures have been about sort of nature, vegetation, soils, water runoff, all those kinds of things. And last time especially, more at the large scale of the city. And external physical considerations, things outside the building that are acting on the building. We're going to be looking at the internal physical considerations. What emanates from inside the building that is important in terms of its reaction to physical considerations. And so today we're primarily looking at structures and materials. How does the actual structure of the building affect the making of architecture? So to kind of get a handle on this, We're going to do a little mini physics lesson here. Just a tiny little lesson in statics and dynamics. And for those of you who are engineering majors, you're going to think this is the most stupid baby stuff we're talking about. And those of you who might be, philosophy major, you're going to think, whoa, that's deep. Phew. That's heavy material. This is technical. Okay, so we're going to have a little variation here. Bear with me. There basically are three forces that act in a building. And this is primarily due to gravity. I mean, what we're talking about in structure and materials is what makes buildings stand up. And we don't want buildings to fall down. This is way back to Vitruvius and firmness and all of that sort of thing. So we're trying to figure out how do you make buildings stand up. And these are the very most fundamental principles that buildings were built on. Something like the pyramids, man, I mean, it's all about holding that building up, standing up, being structurally stable. And its shape and form have a lot to do with physical considerations of gravity. It's a damn heavy building made out of all that stone. It needs to stand up. So we need to understand what forces move through a building and how these forces then are resisted by the structure of the building. So we have three forces that move through buildings. We have four forces that move through buildings. The first one is tension. So if you take a building material and you stretch it, what will happen at a molecular level is that those molecules will detach from each other. And when those molecules detach, the material has no strength anymore. And it fails, and the building falls down. That's what you don't want to happen, is failure of the materials. So the first thing is tension. Imagine taking a piece of wood or something and stretching it like this, maybe putting it chaining it to a car on one side, chaining it to a car on the other side, and you can just feel it splinter and stretch and give way in tension. Okay, a second kind of force is compression, and that's the opposite. We're smashing something together. And what happens then is you put pressure on, again, the molecular structure of the material to the point that it disrupts its molecular bonds and it fails again. So this is compression. And imagine that same piece of wood. And if we had it, attached to a stone wall and we ran a pickup truck into it, and imagine just smashing it, that would be breaking those molecular bonds in compression, and that would be failure in compression. So tension and compression. The third force is bending. And that happens if we take that same piece of wood, and let's say I cracked it over my knee like this, and I bent it. And that's a very common way for something to fail in a building, is that it fails in bending. And that actually is a combination of tension and compression. Think about it. We have this piece of wood, and we start to bend it. Then it's being stretched at the top, being pulled apart, and it's being smashed together at the bottom of that piece of wood. So it's tension on the top, compression on the bottom. The combination of those is bending, and that's a third force we worry about. The fourth force we worry about is shear, and this is where if I took that same piece of wood and I just pulled it straight like that, just sheared it across like that, and that again would disrupt those molecular bonds. And it's actually a combination of tension and compression, but in a much more random way. But that's the force of shear. So we have four forces: tension, compression, bending, and shear. Now, the truth is, although all those are possible, two of those are predominant in buildings, and two of them are pretty rare. They're there, but they're pretty rare. We have very few buildings that actually are designed for tension. The truth is, gravity pushes things down. It doesn't pull things up. So we don't have a lot of tension exerted on buildings. There are some cases. If you go camping and you erect a tent, that is a tensile structure. When you take one of those cables and you put it out to a little, you know, stake, and you hammer it in the ground, and so you've got that cable going from the stake up to one of the poles of your tent, and the wind comes along and it pulls that cable, and it pulls it too much, and it breaks that broken tension. So a tent, even the canvas part of the tent, the actual, you know, walls of the tent, if the wind blows against them and they rip, they're ripping in tension. So some structures do have tension, but we don't have a hell of a lot of tents around, so that's not real common. There's a whole genre of funicular and membrane structures. They're made out of tension, but again, pretty rare. So today we're going to acknowledge we've got tension out there, but we're not going to deal with it a whole lot today. The other thing is shear, that last one I talked about. And shear actually is, it's an important force in some buildings. Like a really tall high-rise building, and where it's connected to the ground, and let's say there's lots and lots of wind in this city, and the wind blows against the high-rise building, and it exerts a big pressure for this building to go that way, but the ground is holding it right here, then there's a shear force right where the building meets the ground. It's trying to shear that building off. But that's only in very, very tall high-rise buildings and in cities that have a lot of wind. So occasionally, but that's usually not a controlling force. Another thing that we design for shear in is earthquakes, because what happens is the ground starts moving sideways like that, and it wants to shear a building, or sideways like this, and you've got a building sitting here, and one piece of ground is moving this way, and the other piece of ground is moving this way. It's shearing the building right there. And in California, you got to design for shear because you got earthquakes. In Texas, we don't have so many earthquakes. So until we do more fracking, who knows? But anyway, right now, we don't design for earthquakes in Texas much. So it's not a big issue. So that leaves us with bending and compression. And so today, we're going to be talking primarily about bending and compression, those two structural forces. And how do we design for bending and compression? Now, what we do when we design the structure of a building is we use certain materials that are good structural materials that have good resistance to these loads put on them. So what are some common building materials? Let's say wood. Probably all of you grew up in a house that was made out of wood. Wood is a pretty good structural material. Why is it good? Because its molecular structure is such that when you apply tension to it, it's pretty good. When you apply compression to it, it's pretty good. It resists that. And because it does both of those about equally well, it's really good in bending. If you're going to have bending force on something, you want it to have both capability in tension and compression and about equal, and wood does. And that's why we use wood so much as a structural material. So it's quite good in tension and compression and bending. Something like steel, oh my God, steel, because of its molecular structure, steel is fantastic in tension, and it's fantastic in compression. And because it's equally good in both of those, it's incredible in bending. So if you want a really, really excellent structural material, you're going to look for steel because it's really good in tension, really good in compression, and really good in bending. Way, way better, actually, than wood would be. That's why we make little buildings out of wood, but we make big buildings with lots of loads out of steel. Okay, let's think of some other building materials. Something like brick. Okay, brick is fantastic in compression. Think about it. You put a brick out on your driveway, and you run your pickup truck over that brick, run back and forth over that brick just is fine, usually. It's perfectly good. But brick is terrible in compression. I mean in tension. It's good in compression. It's terrible in tension. If you, say, put a wire loop around one of the holes in a brick and the other holes in a brick, and then you started to pull it apart, say, with a chain on your car, man, it snaps just like that. Because the molecular bonding of the brick is very different than in wood or steel. You can tell that just by, you know, tossing around or playing with a piece of brick or a piece of wood. Wood has all those fibers that interlock like this, and that makes it really good in tension. And you know, brick is brittle, and it's, you know, you can take a piece of brick and whack it across here and break the brick. It's pretty easy to do that. That's because it's breaking in tension. In compression, it's good. In tension, it's not good. So that means in bending, it sucks, you know, because the tension end of it doesn't work. So it only works in compression. And stone is very much like brick in its molecular makeup. It's earthen. It comes from the same kind of geological material quality. And so it has very similar traits. It's good in compression, not good in tension, and therefore not good in bending. Okay, that's wood, steel, brick, stone, concrete. Concrete as a material, just concrete, which is made out of cement and water and sand and aggregate, meaning little stones. So that's what you do to make concrete. You mix sand and water and cement and aggregate. And you mix it together and it hydrates. It's a chemical reaction of the cement and the water. And that's what makes concrete. Now, concrete, just like that, is like brick and stone. It's good in compression, but it's not very good in tension. But if you make reinforced concrete, that means you put some steel rebar in there, then you get the steel that's good in tension, and you get the concrete that's good in compression. And by putting those together and locating them in just the right place, you can get something that's good in bending. So the combination of tension and compression, use the steel to take the tension load, use the concrete to take the compressive load, and together you can make something that's good in bending. So those are very common building materials. Now it's very simple. There's an easy task here. We design a structure, we see where are the loads, what kind of loads, are they compression, are they bending? Well, by knowing that, I know what kind of material to use. Then shall I use wood, or shall I use brick, or shall I use steel, or shall I use reinforced concrete? And then it's a matter of then quantifying how much is the load. And if I get a lot of load, then I have a material that's more capable, like steel over wood. Or if I have a lot of load, maybe I have a material like reinforced concrete over wood. So these are the kind of choices you make when you design the structure of a building. Okay, this is just for my information. Is there anybody out here who says, I heard every word, but I still don't get it. I'm a little clueless on this structure thing. Anybody feel a little clueless? Fantastic. Okay, you're all engineers. We're ready to give you a stamp, certify you. Not quite. Okay, but this is very, very, at a very elementary level. This is the engineering of a building. And that's what we design for. So today we're going to be looking at compressive loads and what we call bearing structures. Bearing structures, sometimes wall structures. And then we're going to be looking at bending loads, and with them are bending structures, sometimes we call frame structures. So these two distinctly different kinds of structures. And we're going to start with compressive structures. And like I said, you can think just at the most elementary level of the pyramids. That's a compressive structure. It's less load at the top. As it gets more and more and more load as it goes to the bottom, it needs more and more and more compressive material, stone. And because the load has collected bigger and bigger, we need more and more stone. And that's what makes that structure work. If we go out in the backyard and we collect a whole lot of stones off of the ground and we stack them up in a stone wall, we're laying one stone on top of another stone on top of another stone. All of them have weight. Forces of gravity press down. Compressive loads are put. The stones at the bottom have greater load being put on them because they collect the weight of the stones at the top and the weight of the stones in the middle and the weight of the stones at the bottom. And so you might want to make that wall look like this, thicker at the bottom, thinner at the top, because that's how the loads are distributed. So you've found out I have compressive loads. I'm going to use a material that resists compressive loads, like stones, and I'm going to place them so that where there's a larger load, I have a larger amount of that material. This is intuitive, but it also is just really good, simple physics. So let's look at how people build with this and how this starts to tell us something about the form a building takes. And I'm going to make an argument here that you cannot freaking understand architecture, not even a little bit, if you don't understand structure and materials. Because this is what always has made architecture. Fundamental building block. This is architecture at the most basic level, is how the forces move through it, how you place the materials, how you create the structure, what materials you use. This is what makes architecture look, feel, be like it is. So, early times. This is the community of Hattusis in Turkey. This is in central Turkey. It's in the middle of freaking nowhere. It takes you hours going through nowhere to get to nowhere, which is where this city was built. It was started in 6000 BC. That is a hell of a long time ago. This is one of the oldest cities we know of anywhere in the world. This is older than the pyramids. The pyramids are like 2500 BC. This city peaked in about 1350 BC. And at that point, it had 50,000 people in Hattusis. It was a Hittite city. It's Hittite culture. And it was one of the largest cities in the world at 50,000 people in 1350 BC. By 1200 BC, the Hittite nation had been conquered and the city was deserted. So it's pretty much not been there since 1200 BC. Then there were a bunch of German archaeologists who, about 1930, went out to Hattusis, and they have been digging and restoring this city for all the time since the 1930s, like three little German archaeologists at a time. And they've just done this continually. And so that's why we have this city to look at today. Now, it is a city that is based on compressive structures, bearing structures. You see those big, thick walls there? All of those were people's houses. And look how thick those walls were. And they were just made, you can see in the background, you see that hill? See that big rock outcropping? It's a part of the countryside that's got tons and tons of rock. What do they have to build with? Rock. Look around. Do you see any trees? Nope, I don't either. Not much wood to build with. What have we got? We got rocks. What does that mean? Well, we're going to build compressive structures here for the most part. So they became incredibly good masons. On the right, that's a threshold to go into a house, and you can see how they've carved it very precisely to shed the water and to create a nice entry point for the building. If you look at the top of these flat parts right here, you see those little holes? Those are where they would put a peg, and then they would have another stone that would go on top of it. That stone would also have a little hole, and these stone pegs would hold the thing together. Now, that's a lot of work. The way we think they made those pegs was that they had a piece of metal, and that was rare. It's hard to find metal. But they would take this metal rod, and they would do it back and forth with their hands like that. And they would put a little grit on the stone and rub it back and forth like that, and that would start to drill a little hole. And it would take them about 3 days of doing that constantly to make one of those little holes. And then they'd go on and make the next little hole, and then they would use that to peg the stones together. These dudes had patience. And it was hard work doing this stonework, but that's how they built their structures. On the right is one of those beautiful walls. Man, This was all of those stones. You don't see any mortar between them. They're pegged together to keep that compressive load going down. And they've cut them all very precisely with rather primitive tools, but they've made this beautiful stonework out of it. And you can feel the compression in that wall, the weight pushing down and you know, the solidity of that wall. On the left is much more a rubble wall. That would be cheaper. This would be a fancy building on the right. This would be a more ordinary building on the left. But you're just stacking up those rocks. Now, all of that works while you're making a wall. Okay, what happens when you want to make an opening? You want to make a door. Then you want to have a lintel that goes across the top and spans the opening you're going to walk through. That lintel is not in compression. That lintel is in bending. It wants to sag like this. It wants to have tension at the bottom, compression at the top. Stone is not good in bending. So what they did was they made grossly oversized stones to be that lintel where they knew occasionally we're getting a little bending here. And it's tough, but all we got is stone to work with. So especially in that one on the left, you see them struggling to push one stone a little farther out and then a little farther out and make as little a gap as possible and then use this huge stone, which is not good in bending. It can perform badly. It can do the job, but it takes an enormous piece of stone to do that little bitty span because you're placing it in bending and it doesn't want to work in bending. And in fact, it so much doesn't want to work that a lot of times it just says, to hell with it, and it breaks. And so you see all over Hattusha's these places where they tried to use the stone in bending and whoops, it broke. And fall down, go boom, whole building craps out. Not good. So that was their technology of the day. Now they were really good stonemasons. They knew how to carve the stone well. They basically knew how it worked, but they were stretching that material. They were stretching it just as far as they could make it go. And this is in the late period, right before they gave up the ghost of this town. They built this structure, which is taking that compressive material, that material that doesn't want to span, and just by making it a little farther out and a little farther out and a little farther out and a little farther out, until at the top you've got a tiny little span, and then putting a stone there, and it works. And you can make the whole building, the roof, the walls, perfect structure. It all works. And it's all out of this compressive material because you put everything in compression all the way around there. Tiny little bit of bending at the top, but mostly a purely compressive form. This was like sending a man to the moon for the technology of this era. This was really handy. This was something they needed to happen. And they made it, but you know something? This room is about big enough for me to put my fingertips on each side. It's only about a 6-foot span. So they can't make a big room, they can just make a little room. So this is them exploring the technology. Now, the amazing thing is the Hittites did not have that technology. But then fast forward a couple of, you know, 1,000 years, and you get the Romans, and the Romans figured it out. They invented the arch. And the arch is a way you take a compressive material and you keep it in compression the entire time, but whoa, it can span over an opening. It can make a hole in the wall. And when the Romans discovered this, it opened huge doors to what you could do with building and with technology. So the Hittites, all they could do is make all these crappy little rooms. The Romans, suddenly we got great possibilities. So this is an aqueduct that the Romans built in Nîmes, which is in southern France, 14 AD. And they're doing two things with this aqueduct. This is ginormous. This is a huge, huge building. And it goes all the way from one mountain to another mountain, and it's carrying water at the top from one mountain to another mountain. So it's really a water aqueduct. The Romans were great about distributing their water and irrigation, and so it's making them able to do their farming. It's huge for their economy. So it's an aqueduct, but it also is at a lower level here, it's a road. You see that road, that, and they were also big on building roads, so they're building roads and aqueducts, carrying water and carrying people. And they're using the arch which they had invented. And you can see that it follows all the principles of compression. It's just like the pyramids. It's basically small spans at the top and thin walls, and then it gets bigger span and thicker walls as it goes down. And then at the bottom, it's massive, deep, deep walls and big spans over that. And you can just feel those compressive loads now, each stone pressing into the one next to it and carrying that compressive load all along the perfect geometrical shape of the arch and down into those big piers and taking it into the ground. If you have really good eyes, you can see little bitty dots on that roadway, and those are people. This is enormous. And this is still ancient architecture, but by inventing the arch, they figured out how to take compressive materials, put them into shapes and forms that made compressive structures that would allow them to carry enormous loads and make huge structures that accomplished big jobs that they couldn't have accomplished otherwise. And this is a mark of civilization. This is Western civilization growing from a primitive nature in Hittite culture to a more advanced nature in Roman culture. And the essential invention is the arch and the advancement of compressive structures. Now, we look at the Romans and we think of their architecture as beautiful. So millions of people every year flock to Rome to see the Colosseum. The Colosseum is considered a real icon, an important work of Roman architecture, and an absolute image of beauty. How many people here have been to the Colosseum in Rome? Okay. Think of all the money your parents spent to send you or to take themselves to and to freaking go to Rome. And what did you go to Rome for? It probably wasn't the spaghetti, because we got pretty good Italian food right here in the U.S., but I'll tell you, everybody went to see the Colosseum, okay? Everybody goes to see the Colosseum. Why do we see the Colosseum? Because it's a beautiful work of architecture. What makes it a beautiful work of architecture? You know, it's nothing but structure. It's just 100% compressive structure. And you can see it, thinner walls at the top, just like the Pont du Gard. Thinner walls at the top, getting thicker in the middle, getting super thick at the bottom, using the arch as a way of distributing those compressive loads around the opening, into the pier, and into the ground. And there's something freaking beautiful about that simple structure, the elegance of the way that those compressive loads are resolved in that stone material and creating those arches. And those arches aren't there because they're pretty. They're not. They're there because they're structurally perfect for making the kind of architecture that they needed to make for the Colosseum. And one of the great things about the Colosseum is it's falling down. And you can see then it's a little object lesson on what makes a building stand up and then what makes a building fall down. So you can see those arches on the left, and then there are counter arches perpendicular in the other direction, and they have failed. That means their keystone in the center, once that keystone is gone, the arch makes no sense anymore. It only makes sense if everything is in place and all of those loads are being carried evenly down the sides. When you take the arch and you make it a three-dimensional form, you get a vault. And that's what we're seeing in the slide on the right. Half of that vault has its keystone is gone and it's sheared away. But you can see how that vault was made of these thick, thick, massive brick constructions that are carrying that compressive load around and making a shelter for passageway in the Colosseum. So, gorgeous architecture. How did that architecture get to be? It's just structure and materials. It is what nature, gravity, told the architect that wanted to be, because that's the nature of those materials they're building out of, brick. in that case. So another great Roman building. This was just down the street from the Colosseum. The Pantheon. Probably on your trip to Rome, you also went to see the Pantheon. Another incredible, incredible work of Roman architecture. And it is just the notion of the arch, but now completely in 360 degrees. And you can see that at the very top, we don't have any loads. We have the oculus. We have a void at the top. But then you begin to collect loads slowly as you go down that dome. And that dome, the shape of the dome, is exactly the sort of three-dimensional version of the shape of the arch. And that's collecting those loads, and they're all in compression, and they're going down into those big, thick stone walls. In this case, 20-foot thick stone walls. That's like, those stone walls are from here to the wall. That's how thick the stone walls are at the Pantheon. And they're thick at the bottom, and then as they make that dome at the top, they taper slowly, slowly, slowly until they get up the oculus, and then the material disappears. But the whole shape and form and character of the building has everything to do with distributing loads. You see up at the top in the slide on the left, we have the oculus, and then it's getting thicker and thicker and thicker and thicker and thicker, and then finally becomes this big, deep wall at the bottom of the building. And in between there, when they want to open up a little niche in that wall, then they're using another arch to take those loads around here and distribute them down into the wall so we can make a little niche to put some bit of ornament or a religious icon or something like that. On the slide on the left, you can see what is it made out of. Actually, this one is made out of a combination of brick and stone and what's called rubble concrete. Rubble concrete means it doesn't just have small aggregate. We threw in some really big stones in there too. So it's kind of a stone wall, kind of a concrete wall, but it's a mixture of stone and concrete. And that's what makes up the walls of the Pantheon, those 20-foot thick walls. And then you can see internal some arches where they need to, where they're opening up a niche on the other side, and you can see the structural arch marching through. Okay. That was astounding in Roman times. In 120 AD, that would have been an amazing building because the span of it was huge. It's like wider than this room and completely open. And think of those poor dudes in Hattusis who couldn't make something more than 6 feet across. They didn't know how to do a compressive structure to do that. And then, you know, the Romans are like wiping them out, making them look like idiots with these big open rooms that they can make with a dome. But even the Romans got put to shame 400 years later in the building of the Hagia Sophia in Constantinople. And this was built, it actually was a late Roman structure beginning to be Byzantine, but it's the very end of the Roman Empire, and Constantine is the guy who's founding Constantinople, moving the capital of the empire to Constantinople, now Istanbul, and creating this new, what was at the time, a Christian religious building, later became a Muslim, very important Muslim religious building. But again, stupendous compressive structure. So now it not only has the dome in the center, but then around that dome it has two huge hemidomes, semi-domes, half-domes, and then around that it has on each side three other semi-domes to make this enormous open space, almost like a football field, inside the building. And then to carry all those loads as they move down, then at the edge you get these enormous buttresses. Again, everything in compression, everything being carried down from the top, through the walls, into the semi-domes, down to the buttresses, and finally into the ground. All of that in compression. But it made it possible to have this big open space, even an open space with windows in it, little penetrations, tiny little penetrations that have arches that carry the load around them. So you get light in the center of the building, but it's all pushing those loads out and down in these enormous buttresses at the end down there. And around the sort of entry portals of Hagia Sophia, you then get a whole series of just regular barrel vaults, like on the left, or what we call groin vaults. That's vaulted in two directions, kind of like your groin between your legs. There's that splaying in different directions. That's a groin vault. And you can see in plan that big dome in the center where the circle is. On either side, there's a semi-dome, which is making it even bigger. And then on the outside of that, there are these little three semi-domes so that you get this enormous open space in the center of the building. And then everything else on the outside is collecting those big loads from the middle and distributing them out and out and out and down in those thick, massive masonry walls at the edge. So in the end, you get these enormous open spaces of the dome and the semi-dome and the three semi-domes on the side of it. All of those loads being carried to the outside. And in the end, what was at the time? Again, like going to the freaking moon. I mean, no one had ever seen anything like this. I mean, if you were thinking of toppling the Roman Empire, you go in there and you say, dude, these guys know what they're doing. We can't begin to do this in our culture. So it was a real advancement of technology. Okay, those are all compressive structures and domes and vaults and things like that. Let's think of more kind of ordinary applications of this. This is an architect in the late 19th century in the United States, H.H. Richardson, the foremost American architect of the 19th century. He's practicing in Boston. Got a rich fat cat out here who has a big estate, and he's building a gate lodge for the whole estate. Basically, it's where the caretaker lives, but you drive for security. There's an entry point here. So he wants this massive kind of arch that you will go through and the caretaker's cottage on the side. And he's really, it's not like this is a heroic structural job. Building that arch is a fairly big job. But what he's doing here is using the compressive forces as a way of stimulating architectural character. He's building this out of the local stone, which is Roxbury pudding stone. And he's shaping it in such a way that we feel the pressure and the heaviness of the stone resting on stone. And it gives character to the building. It is the structure that is giving the primary character of the building. And then sometimes when you need an arch, he emphasizes the importance of the keystone, that piece right there, how critical that is, by pulling it out a little bit. Sometimes he doesn't actually use an arch. Sometimes he uses, like the Hittites did, this massive beam. But you see how, you know, it's doing a big job. It's having a hard time here. And it's kind of a heroic gesture there. And then there is the big arch that is where the carriages go through, and it opens it up. But this is understanding compressive forces as a means of expression, as a means of giving character to the building. Just down the street, he did the town hall in the same little village of Northeastern. And in this case, there are these big outcroppings of Roxbury pudding stone that happen all over around there. And so he's starting the building by making a terrace that is masonry compressive materials, like the masonry compressive materials of the ground itself. And the building is now just growing out of the ground, getting a little more refined. And then it turns into these big arches. And now they're arches that feel heavy. They're big, wide arches. It's like they smash down on these little piers that support them, little bitty squatty piers here. And the arch goes into a capital of the pier that receives the load and then carries it through the pier and then down to a thicker base that carries it down into the ground. And all of that articulation has to do with transferring loads from one piece of the building to another piece of the building and giving you a sense of the massiveness of those loads. And then as you go up in the building, we go from the very strong structural material of stone to a little bit less strong material of brick above that. And then finally, we have a wood roof that's spanning on the top of that. But The architecture here is all about structure. It's light at the top, heavy at the bottom. It is a kind of pyramid. It's getting thicker and more massive as it goes into the ground, and then eventually transferring those loads right into the rock, the stone of the base down there. Now, that's a means of expression in the 19th century. It also is in the 20th century. Here we find our old friend Le Corbusier, who's doing this house in Paris, actually two houses for two brothers, the Maison Jaoux. And these two houses, each of them have masonry walls, these long, thick walls that go the length of the building, three walls in each house. And then between those walls, he's making a vault, the same thing we saw happening in the Colosseum, but now in a very modern way. This vault is what's called a flat vault. You know, it's not complete half circle. It's just a segment of a circle. That means that the loads don't get resolved down like they do at the end of a half circle. They go down into the pier. But these are still pressing out a little bit. And because they're pressing out, they would tend to push the pier over. And to counter that pushing the pier over, he puts in this steel bar. That steel bar is holding the two walls together. And that bar is in tension. And why would you use steel? Because steel is good in tension. And the brick that the rest of the house is made out of is not good in tension. So he's using that little tensile member to counterbalance the forces that are being placed by the masonry vault on the masonry walls on either side. And again, all of the character of the building comes from those massive brick walls, come from the shape of that vault. That vault, a structural device to span the distance with a compressive material like brick, but then to counterbalance that geometry with the tension rods that connect the building back together. Another example, 20th century, using these same kind of compressive loads to make a building structure and give it character. This is Morrison Stiles Hall at Yale University. The architect is Eero Saarinen. We've looked at Saarinen's work before. TWA terminal at Kennedy Airport, that zoopy, zoomy, you know, bird-like structure about flying. Here, this is about the same era. But now he's working on the Yale campus. And the Yale campus has all these neo-Gothic buildings, like this one right here. That's actually the gymnasium, if you can believe that. But the gym has this big neo-Gothic tower, and it has all these masonry piers. And, you know, Eero Saarinen wanted to do a building that didn't look stupid next to that masonry gym. So he builds a building that is a masonry building. Now it's actually made of rubble concrete, the same thing I talked about in the Pantheon. So what they do is they put up big formwork and they pour in a whole bunch of rocks, just loose rocks, and then they pour in concrete around the rocks so that it is like solid concrete, but it's got big aggregate, big stones in it. And you can see the texture of those stones on the outside of the wall. It actually makes a very beautiful wall, but it's a big compressive wall. And that compressive wall is about the same kind of color and texture as that, which actually is a brick wall. But that has those loads going to the ground. This has the loads going in the ground. And in the same way, it's made out of these big panels of concrete, rubble concrete, and little gaps between which are the windows. Just like in the neo-Gothic structure, you have the big panels of masonry with the little gaps in between that are the windows. So he's making something that is appropriate to the context. He's making it out of a compressive material, which is compatible with the compressive materials around. He's using forms that are sensible for that compressive material, these load-bearing masonry walls. And the whole character of the building has everything to do with the character of the context around. This is the graduate school. It has its tower too, very compatible with architecture of the dormitories at Moores and Stiles Hall. So all of this is a series of, we've taken everything from the Hittites, 6,000 BC, all the way to the 20th century, not that long ago, and contemporary buildings, modern buildings, every kind of building, it doesn't matter what style it is. The character of that building comes from its structure, from the way the loads are carried, the materials that are there to resist those loads, and what appropriate shapes and forms those take. Okay, that's all compressive loads and bearing structures. Now, completely different thing here. Shift gears in your mind, and now we're talking about bending structures. And we're talking about frame structures, like columns and beams, a completely different way of building. And now almost everything is in bending. If a column is loaded up at the top here, how is it going to fail? It's going to bend like that, have compression on one side, tension on the other side, and fail in bending. If a beam is going to fail, you put loads on top of a beam, it's going to sag like that, it's going to bend, it's going to have tension at the bottom, compression at the top. So what do we need? What kind of material do we need for bending? Well, wood is a very good material for bending. And that's exactly what the Japanese figured out in the 15th century when they're building all these castles all over Japan. There are these powerful daimyos that are kind of feudal lords. And Japan is a heavily, heavily forested country. We don't think of this, but it's some of the most beautiful topography in the world. Mountains, heavily forested, tons and tons of wood around. So what are they building out of? They're building out of wood. So how do you build in wood? You build in bending. You build a frame structure. And it makes all the sense in the world. So they're building these enormous castles, and they're building them, as you see in the model on the right, as wood frame structures. This one is Matsui Castle in Japan. At the bottom, it's compression. When they come out of the ground, they use the stone. But then as soon as they get away from the dampness of the ground and foundation and all that, then they turn it into a wood structure. Only it's massive pieces of wood, these enormous columns and beams, tree-like structures. And they can't calculate exactly how much it takes. And they're loading it up. It's a pretty tall building. But you can see those big columns and beams and frame wood structure. This is Todaiji, a little bit later Japanese building. It's a Buddhist temple in Nara in Japan. This one is reputed to be the biggest wooden building in the world. You can get a sense. You see those tiny little dots there? Those are people. So it's a big, big temple. And everything is massive pieces of wood. Now they're taking whole trees, and they're converting them into columns, and they're hewing them into beams. And it makes long spans, and it makes, you know, a big monumental and open structure. And then adjacent to it, there are all these other smaller buildings. And with a frame structure, you can begin to get a totally different building character. You get all these cantilevers, and you get a lightness, an airiness. The buildings now aren't massive, they aren't dark, they aren't closed. You can open them up, you can get lots of light, lots of windows. Completely changes the building character because that's what the frame wants to do. And you're cutting them now into different sizes of pieces to take different kinds of loads. All of these in bending, whether it's a beam or whether it's a truss or whether it's a girder or a purlin or any of those pieces are all going to be in bending, and they're made out of that same wood material. This is a lovely little village in Japan. And what happened in Japan was they kind of began to run out of wood. They had limited resources. So instead of continuing to build in that massive wood structure, they began to get much more efficient and to think, how can we build economically? Make the wood go as far as possible. And this little town of Sumago is a good example of that, where they're in the middle of the woods, they're using that limited resource, And they're beginning to find better and better ways to build with wood. How can we make the pieces smaller? How can we make the span longer? How can we make the rooms lighter? And you begin to see these frames, and now not the chunky big pieces of wood, but much more appropriately engineered and scaled. And now they're making all these connections with mortise and tenon joints in them, very precise, very good intersections of those, beautiful craftsmanship, great exactness. And out of this is coming Japanese architecture, an architecture that we very much appreciate. It's world-renowned, the finesse, the delicacy of it. But it's coming out of wood construction. It's coming out of frame construction, of bending and how you appropriately deal with that in a building. And that it means on the inside, now we don't have massive thick walls that separate us from the outside. We in fact can have big openings. They invent the shoji screen, which is made out of a wood frame, and then they make the paper from the wood that fills it in. And they're using it as economically as they possibly can. They're making those trees go just as far as they can, making the lightest, thinnest enclosure they can make. And then they can begin to have this wonderful relationship with the garden, because now you can dissolve the wall. It doesn't have to be massive and thick like you make out of masonry. So we don't have to have a base on that castle that keeps us away from the garden or nature. Now we can open and slide these doors open and have complete intersection of the garden and the house. And again, the architecture is being shaped and formed by the technology of the structure and the ability of that frame to open up the edges of the building, even open up the rooms to each other inside the building and make more flexible and continuous spaces inside. Now, that's not just happening in Japan. There's also the invention of similar technologies in Europe. This one is in England, in Stratford-upon-Avon. We call that half-timbered building. They're building out of a frame. It's happening in the U.S. on the left. We invented the balloon frame building made out of studs, little pieces of wood instead of bigger pieces of wood. But it's all technology that's utilizing these materials at hand, wood. We know it's good in bending. How do we optimize the performance of that wood? How do we maximize that resource? And that begins to shape and form a certain kind of architecture. And then in the 19th century, we invent the Bessemer process of making steel. That takes iron ore, makes it much, much, much stronger. And it becomes a much better building material. And so we make steel frames, as you see on the right. And we can build high-rise buildings. Before that, we can't freaking build a tower. We can't build a high-rise building. We don't have the technology for it. It was inventing steel with the Bessemer process, and then it was understanding that as a frame structure, and how would you then make that into a structure that could become a tall building, 30, 40 stories, and now 100 stories. On the left, that's using that same steel technology, but now using reinforcing bars. See the little frame of reinforcing bars, and putting it in concrete, and making reinforced concrete construction. Again, really good in bending. And you can see those loads going from the beams, transferring themselves into the columns, the shape of it really reflecting the loads as they move through the building. Now, that then gives us the character of a wood frame house. Columns, beams, frame expressing itself inside, outside. Lots of glass, connectivity to garden. The Strimling House here in Massachusetts is a great example of this. Very open, very integral with the exterior kind of building. And that goes to everything in the house, from the major frame of it all the way down to shelving and pieces of furniture, as you can see in the slide on the right. And it goes to much more massive buildings, like steel frame buildings. This one is by Mies van der Rohe, who we've talked about before. One of his most famous projects, the Lakeshore Drive Apartments, right on the Lake Michigan in Chicago. Two towers, a whole new way of living now, you know, in a high-rise building up in the air. And you can see that simple frame as it makes the grid on the ground. And then all of the apartments fit into that frame of the building. And the expression on the outside, we see a steel frame. We see the columns and beams and structure. This is how it looks in reality when you're putting it together with rivets and it's a little messy and reinforcing plates. But then Mies kind of simplifies it in the slide on the left. And you see this elegant intersection of columns and beams and the making of the structure of that building. And then on the inside, oh my God, beautiful views. You know, you're way up in the air and you've got great open vistas of the lake and of the city. All of that enabled by the structure. Until we could get a frame structure that could do that, all of that was an impossible thing to experience. But it's what created that kind of architecture. And then maybe the ultimate example of that frame creating an architectural expression is this building by Eero Saarinen again, same guy who did Morrison Stiles College, same guy who did TWA, the John Deere headquarters that he built in Moline, Illinois. In this case, he's building a big corporate headquarters building for a company that makes tractors, makes these technological devices, these steel objects that plow the farms of the Midwest. So there's something in that technology and in that simplicity and in that earthiness of steel that now he's translating into a whole building very much made out of steel and articulating with these passing connections, the column, the girder, the beam, the purlin, every piece, almost like tinker toys, explaining to you how you make this structure, how you build. And when you were a little kid, you did this with blocks, or you did this with erector set, or you did this with Legos. But understanding how all those structural pieces assemble together to make, now in this case, this corporate office environment. And then he adds on to that little linear thin pieces of sun shading, and the assembly all becomes this series of frames, light, delicate, that sit in the woods and really talk a little bit about the trees that are also light, delicate frames themselves, made of a material that is good in tension and compression and resists bending, which is what a tree does itself, and very compatible in that regard. And then from the inside, these big open areas, wonderful vistas out to nature, big span so that you can get inside there, display areas for tractors and backhoes and these big objects that John Deere makes. Even the office environment, the frame continuing in the ceiling, in the grid, seeing the whole thing made out of that way of shaping a building. Now, the bottom line here, this is a point I've made before, that it is so stupid to think of, well, what was Eero Saarinen's architectural style? He's just like going out there and badass thinking, I want to make this shape, or I want to make that shape, or whatever. No. Eero Saarinen is understanding physical considerations. He's understanding on the right how you build out of masonry, how you build a compressive structure. And Morrison Stiles College is about heavy, massive, compressive walls, because that was appropriate on the Yale campus that was full of heavy, massive, compressive walls. On the left, at exactly the same time, he's doing John Deere headquarters in Moline, Illinois, where it's all about views out to nature, steel, industrial materials, and he's making a frame that is light and thin and delicate and could not be more different as a building than Morrison Stiles College. Now, for your Twitter card question today, I want you to think of a building, anywhere, any building, that the character of that building comes from structural expression. There's something there that really lets you see, and hopefully you can even say, this is a compressive structure, like think Pantheon, Colosseum in Rome, Morrison-Stiles College, or it's an expression of a bending structure, a frame structure, like Lakeshore Drive apartments or like a wood frame house or whatever. A piece of architecture, a building that, or it could be a bridge or it could be anything that expresses to you the structure and gets its shape or form because it's understanding structure.